Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday. You're listening to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich, and you, sir, as always, are Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, I think all of us knew on 9/11 that our world was changing forever.
I think by the 12th, we were
Very
starting
much.
To get that idea.
Yeah.
But it really began to come out in ensuing weeks. But how the world has changed and what kind of narrative we now hear about those changes is the subject of our first conversation this morning. Now, in a few weeks, the U.S. will mark the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. After all the changes those years have brought, the issues we continue to grapple with are whether we're now better able to understand how to fight and how to face terrorism. An article in the September issue of The Atlantic magazine is based on a year-long study, and in it, writer Stephen Brill asks a basic question: are we safer? Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with a look at Brill's position and a couple of responses to it. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Okay, so first of all, let's talk about what did Stephen Brill find after looking at this year-long study?
Well, he found a lot of things. He found, first of all, there is some good news. How much terrorism we've stopped is very hard to discover. But some of the good news is that our intelligence operation is much more consolidated than it was before the some of the intelligence gathering operations, particularly the NYPD, are good. There are certain kinds of pamphlets and materials that are out there. We have in place a reasonably good TSA for checking airplanes, so that we are certainly much more organized around certain things than we were before. The bad news, first of all, there's conventional bad news. Not surprisingly, a lot of money was wasted. There was a sudden urge to spend a lot of money to fix this problem, and as soon as you do that, you open up yourself for all kinds of possibilities of waste and so on. And some of the big ones, for example, $47 billion of money to develop a kind of communication system between first responders that probably wasn't necessary, going down the tubes. So that's examples of good and bad news. What's really important is what I call complicated news, which is about the fact that the nature of terrorism has changed, and slowly that has led to a kind of reemphasis on how to approach this.
When we came through 9/11, those first weeks, there seemed to be the idea that we would be able to surmount it, that we were going to be able to get through it, and then we were going to stop this, you know, stop it from ever happening again. But that narrative has been changing over all of these years. And now the idea seems to be that we need to know how to manage it. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think that's one way of saying it. The important word is resiliency, and our movement toward resiliency has been kind of gradual, sort of reluctant, and so on. The initial response from 9/11, and to some extent still now, is that we have to go on with our lives, but we can do things to mitigate this. We can do things to stop terrorism. And much of our operation is set up with the idea that you can stop terrorism. What's begun to happen, particularly as the nature of terror has changed, when we've moved into people, as one person described it, you're looking for one guy in the basement who can be influenced, and carry out his own terror attack without any kind of coordination from anybody else. That's begun to change the focus. And what one of the writers, Catherine Mongu Ward, says is that really what Brill documented is what it's like fighting the last war, because this kind of thing against terrorism is very different. And that's where the idea of resiliency starts coming in. World leaders like Obama and Hollande in France have begun to try to move people into thinking more about what resilience means.
Angela Merkel, too. But
yes,
as we look at this idea of resiliency, there's a lot of pushback to that, particularly from a certain sector that wants to be able to create a walled-off America, sort of, you know, this island of goodness that nothing else can touch, because everything we do to be able to keep ourselves safe is working so well, or can work so well. That seems to be a bit of a fantasy.
Well, it's a bit of a fantasy, but it's to some extent an understandable one. Let's go back to look quickly at what resiliency means. Resiliency is based on the notion that you simply cannot stop all terror, that terrorist attacks are going to be a part of American life for an indefinite period. And as horrible as they are, and this is also important, they're not an existential threat. They're horrible, but they're not an existential threat. So what you begin to do is to focus on things like quick recovery, like training first aid, first responders to have more coordination, that what you're trying to do is to bring people back from these things as fast as possible and to get over the fact that you can stop all terror and that you have to spend that terror money, anti-terror money, always gets first priority. There are two problems. There are two challenges to that idea. One challenge is psychological. People, a narrative, a story of somebody in pain, a horrible event drives people's fears and it makes them overemphasize risk. The second one is political. You're living in a world right now in America, and Donald Trump is a good example, where he is trying to mobilize folks with a fair amount of success around the idea that you can wall off America, literally with the wall in some places, but that we can prevent terrorism by essentially doing old mitigation things, like doing more to keep them from happening, and that keeping out immigrants, keeping out Muslims. And that tension is very real. And as I say, it's not simply a kind of political propaganda, that it does play on people's fears. And fear of immigrants and fear of Islam is an important component of lots of people who are influenced by Trump.
We saw that in those early days and years after 9/11 with the Patriot Act, where people were willing to trade off, in many cases, personal liberties to get that feeling of safety. Clearly, none of these narratives is the one. But given the fact that we are where we are now, 15 years later, and looking at what those 15 years have wrought, what then becomes a realistic narrative for us in looking at this idea of, are we really safer, or how do we keep ourselves safer?
Well, I think that in my opinion, you have to move a little bit away from safety and ask, how can we make ourselves resilient? How can we make ourselves more resilient? And I don't want to make that sound insensitive, because it's going to mean that we're going to have to realize that two things. First of all, that there's going to be some terrible suffering and that we can recover from those suffering. That's not to take away the empathy and the sympathy we feel for others. The second thing is, as Karen Munger Ward points out, and I want to add, she's the editor of a libertarian magazine, and
Reason.
And she's got a very kind of interesting way of thinking about it, which isn't all that different from the others, but she's more clear. Sometimes you're going to have to understand that there are good reasons for not using money for anti-terrorist activity, because the world has other priorities. She uses the example of why a hospital won't spend a whole lot of money for more biohazard protection, because she says, look, they've got a lot of other things that they need to do, like another MRI, and trying to get people to see the world in terms of the choices and the risks that we have to face.
What it seems like she is saying, and what you've just reiterated, is that we're looking at this through the lens of cost-benefit analysis. What money you're going to put that's going to get you, the most important aspects of this, and not necessarily take away from others that might be even more important.
I think that's right. Cost-benefit analysis always has a kind of sterile economic wonk notion to it. But I think, in a sense, that's how we live our lives anyway. We make those kind of decisions. What we often do in those kinds of decisions is to overemphasize the importance of some kind of risk. And it's understandable. It's psychologically built into us. In some ways, it's evolutionary. But I think what the other pieces, and to some extent Friedman are trying to get you, the Stephen Brill are trying to get you to think about, is that essentially we have to apply the same thing to terrorism, and we have to understand that these kinds of things are going to be part of our lives, and the important thing is to figure out how to recover from them, not so much to think that you can prevent them.
Or be driven by fear.
But to tell people you shouldn't be driven by fear is pretty hard. You have to do a whole series of things to demonstrate what positively you can do in situations like this and emphasize situations.
So just very briefly, doesn't this sort of harken back to that idea about nothing to fear but fear itself, if you really want to take it to that logical extension?
Well, I think that's right. But there are things to fear. You know, Roosevelt's speech, in context, he said a lot of other things that made that statement so powerful. There are other things to fear, some of which we can control, some of which we can't control. But the important thing may be to recover from the things that really are the worst case scenarios.
Neil Milner, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sure.
Political scientist Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. And the article he was discussing, the Stephen Brill article from The Atlantic, is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.